Spying on the Reich, the Cold War against Hitler. Exactly a century ago, intelligence agencies across Europe first became aware of a fanatical German nationalist. His political party was rapidly gathering momentum. His name was Adolf Hitler. From 1933, these spy services watched with growing alarm as they tried to determine what sort of threat Hitler's regime would now pose to the rest of Europe. It is the subject of a fascinating new book, Spying on the Third Reich. It's by R.T. Howard. Delighted to be joined live on the line by, can we call you Roger? Roger Howard himself.
Roger Howard.
Good to have you with us. I suppose it's something that we don't really look at. We suppose that, you know, the rise or the descent of Germany into collective madness took the rest of Europe by surprise. But obviously there were spy networks. Spy networks had been running since for several hundred years, I suppose, in the case of the British Strike English. But we don't tend to think about them monitoring what was happening in Germany.
Well, that's right. There were spy networks left after the end of the First World War, spy networks run by, for example, Britain and France, and other countries too, like the Czechs and the Russians. But they weren't developed. They were very badly resourced. And, of course, they were overshadowed by other threats, most obviously, in the case of Britain and France, by the perceived threat from Bolshevik Russia. So Nazi Germany was actually not considered to be very much of a threat up until around about the mid-1930s, though, of course, a lot of people disagree with that. But we didn't have the resources, unfortunately, to keep the sort of presence in Germany that we'd have liked. And as I say, it was overshadowed by other perceived threats as well for the British, perceived threats from other parts of the world, like, for example, Imperial Japan and China. So to answer your question, yes, we did have our finger on the pulse on events in Germany, but perhaps not quite as much as we'd have liked.
And it's an interesting point you make that, because we tend to maybe overlook that fact at first glance, that the fact that the perceived problem or the perceived threat came out of Bolshevik Russia. So they were, and several nations were, you know, quite happy to let sort of Germany do, if you like, in modern parts, their own thing, as long as they weren't going to the left. And there had been street fighting, violent street protests in Germany between left and right, of course. And it was a case of, as long as they're not sort of following in the footsteps of Russia, we'll kind of let them get on with it.
Well, that's right. I mean, with hindsight, obviously, that seems absurd. It seems extraordinary that we could have downplayed the threat, or perceived threat from Hitler. But as you say, in the circumstance of the time, it's so easy to overlook or ignore how things actually look to people on the ground. And a lot of people argue that Hitler's demands up to about 1936 were probably quite reasonable. I mean, obviously, if you scratched under the surface, if you looked at things like Mein Kampf and heard him or met him or saw him, then obviously things would look very different. But to a lot of outsiders, his demands didn't seem so very unreasonable.
And of course, the other thing is the fact that, you know, Germany in the Weimar Republic, etc. But it was a mess. There was the massive inflation. I mean, there was mass unemployment, of course. And now we know, as you said so correctly, with hindsight, that these are the seeds for extremism. But at the time, people thought, well, you know, Germany's never going to get itself together. You know, we might as well, as you say, concentrate on what's coming out further east.
Well, that's right. I mean, it does seem extraordinary that Germany should have been so resurgent so quickly. I mean, from 1819, as you say, in the ashes of the First World War, it was in such a terrible state in so many different respects, and racked, as you say, by the hyperinflation of the early mid-1920s. And it does seem extraordinary with hindsight that it was able to reassert itself with such dramatic speed. And I think a lot of people were taken very by surprise by that. So, as you say, it's true today. I mean, how do foreign governments or how do foreign intelligence services keep pace with the sheer speed with which change happens? I mean, it's a huge demand for everything and everyone. And, of course, it's obviously true in the world today with things like Ukraine and Russia happening with such dramatic speed and unexpected speed. So it's a lesson for the present day as well.
When we look at spy services or anything from in the Second World War, or the rise of Hitler and the Nazis, we tend to look at it from, okay, we look at perhaps the way that the Soviet Union viewed Germany, and we look at Britain and France and to a certain extent the US, but they didn't really get into it until much later. But we tend to overlook other nations, the Danes, the Czechs, the Poles, who were bordered by this, and must have been looking on it with some alarm. I mean, what were their intelligence services saying at that time?
Well, that's a very interesting point. We don't hear so much about that. There are various reasons for that, but they had their own spy services, again, under-resourced, the same reason that almost other countries after the First World War were so cash-strapped in such tough economic times. But they were able to run a number of very successful agents into the Reich. One reason for that, in the case of the Danes, for example, was because of their geographical proximity, and indeed the Czechs too. They could get people and infiltrate people straight into the country. There were certain routes that the Germans weren't able to seal off, so you could move those people in and out of the country relatively easily. But you also had a lot of ethnic, you also had a lot of Czech nationals who were also ethnic Germans, but who sympathized with the Czechs for whatever reason. And they, again, like with the Poles, and they were able to infiltrate the country. they were able to speak native German. They passed as Germans, but they had sympathies with, say, the Polish government or the Czechs or whatever. And that made them invaluable from the viewpoint of intelligence assets. But again, we don't hear so much about it. I mean, the head of the Czech intelligence services wrote a successful book in the 1970s, which is rather forgotten today. And again, there are a lot of stuff. There's a lot of material being unearthed in the Czech archives and the Polish archives, which I was able to access. But it's relatively unknown. And it was able to, in some cases, get into the hands of British and French intelligence chiefs who are hugely grateful for it. And it played a very important part in formulating the threat assessment of Germany by Whitehall and by politicians as war approached in 1939.
We talk about the threat assessment, but if you're looking at, and this is basically, you know, on a basic history level, i.e. you know, O-level history, and that dates me, but with the narrative seems to be, well, okay, so, you know, Germany takes Sudetenland, takes over Austria, you know, for various degrees. That's a friendly or a hostile taker, depending on how you look at it. But if you look at the scenes from Vienna, it sort of makes your mind up. And then you seem to think, okay, well, everything then is the Blitzkrieg. It takes everybody by surprise. They roll, you know, they devastate the Poles. They roll through Holland in 10 days, Belgium falls, etc., and France. Were there any modern parlance red flags being waved then? Because all that narrative that suddenly, you know, the Allies find themselves, or Britain and France finds itself completely poleaxed by this, and that is one of the reasons that they, you know, they huddle together, and we have, you know, Britain coming into the war because it supports Poland.
Well, it's a very interesting point. I mean, at what point did Western intelligence services and their political chiefs say, or should have said, that this is a red flag? At what point did Hitler seem to go too far? I mean, it's still being debated today. Was it in 1936 when Hitler seized the occupied Rhineland? Was it 1938 when he showed such audacity in seizing Austria? Was it at Munich? Or was it later on? It's very open-ended. I mean, I personally think that in 1936, at the time when he seized the Rhineland, I think he showed a degree of brazen audacity that should have really set the alarm bells ringing. I think, really, to answer your question, in the circumstances of the time, probably a lot of people really knew that war was inevitable by early 1939, possibly earlier than that. But again, to really accept that and act on those intelligence warnings, it's very, very difficult for people when they were still recovering from the First World War. So I think there was this big problem there.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that point up, because again, we look at this with hindsight. We know what happens, but the fear that after people had lived through the horrors of the First World War and the trench warfare, etc., to be dragged, because nobody knew that it was going to be Blitzkrieg, etc., and so the fear was that this would be a repeat of the horrors of what was happening in the fields of Flanders.
Well, that's right. I mean, we had a lot of information coming through, often very accurate information about what changes might Hitler be carrying out to the German army, what his generals might be wanting to do. But actually, it's very difficult to know what sort of war lay ahead once things did break out. And things like Blitzkrieg, for example, though we had some indication from certain sources about that, it was by no means clear how that might play out on the battlefield. So it was very unclear what was going to happen. But what was clear, as you say, is that the the emotional and physical impact and economic impact of the First World War was so huge that, and so relatively recent, that it was going to take an awful lot to make people accept that war was going to come, which did seem virtually inevitable after about March 1939.
When you have governmental agencies of any type, but especially when it comes to the intelligence services, which are by their very nature secretive, they have to be, working with other countries, I mean, even when you have, you know, Britain working with Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, it can be problematic. So, what was the relationship like then before, between the various intelligence services? How, and again, double agents everywhere, the national pride at stake, were they able to sort of form a coherent overview from the various intelligence agencies?
Well, that's certainly very much the sub-theme of my book. You have all these different governments and their respective spying agencies who are latterly almost united by the perceived threat from Nazi Germany. That was probably true in the months that preceded the outbreak of war in September 39. But up until then, there was so much mistrust and rivalry between those governments and their respective spy services that necessarily hindered how they were going to work together or could possibly work together to actually get more information from their spies, respective spies in Nazi Germany. I mean, the most obvious example is the rivalry, intense rivalry and ill feeling between Poland and Czechoslovakia, rivalry between Britain and France, which worked probably both ways. Those suspicions and rivalries were being played out the whole time between those respective spy services. On a personal level, a lot of them got on very well. They could meet, they could, you know, have go out with drinks and beers and everything else and socialize, and they liked each other very much. But the level of rivalry was certainly very intense, and that was just, it's always going to be true. It's true within governments. It's true, for example, between MI5 and MI6, there probably is greater rivalry there, or the CIA and the FBI. And it was even more marked between governments and their respective services.
And presumably these agencies were sending about reports, not only of the, you know, the hierarchy, the higher up in the Reich, but also ordinary Germans, because as I said, I mean, I'm fascinated by the Reich in the way that, you know, the whole country undergoes, if you like, a collective psychosis, and what they do cleverly is they tap into some twisted sort of history in which they turn to their own advantage, saying, well, this is the reason why we are Germans and we do this and this is our destiny, and everybody again sort of buys into it, quote unquote.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's a rather terrifying aspect of human nature. We all think we're immune to that sort of mass psychosis. In practice, very few of us are. It's a very Orwellian point. Do we all love Big Brother in the end? As George Orwell famously asked. And I personally am not terribly optimistic about human nature in that respect. But before I go off on a slight tangent, to answer your question, yeah, the intelligence services were very interested to know what public and popular attitudes were towards Hitler and the Third Reich. They needed to know that if, for example, there's going to be public pressure on Hitler not to use military force against foreign countries. That did seem to be true in 1938. Even a dictator like Hitler still had to respect popular opinion if you've got popular uprisings against things like food shortages, just as war's going to break out. Or indeed, you've got anti-war demonstrations in the big cities, just as, again, war scares are happening. Then, again, that is a matter of real interest to foreign intelligence services. And that did matter, for example, in the weeks and even days running up to the outbreak of war in 1939. And there were intelligence reports reaching London and Paris saying that there were popular demonstrations and even violence that the Gestapo was struggling to contain in mainly Hamburg, as Hamburg was a big city of dissent. One reason or another. Again, that actually raised British hopes and probably hopes in Paris too, that war could be averted and Hitler would actually back down and not invade Poland. So it was very important to get this sort of feedback about what popular attitudes were towards Hitler.
One of the reasons that people have repulsion, well, a very good reason people have repulsion against Hitler and everything and the Nazis and everything they stood for, was of course their belief of the superiority of races, and with Heydrich and Eichmann to a certain extent, you know, we saw what was the beginning of a, you know, terrible terrible situation towards the situation of the Jewish population in Germany. Were there any indications that the intelligence services that you found were sending back that should have been, again, ringing alarm bells, triggering red flags, etc.?
Well, again, this is so interesting, this point you raise. Obviously, the very shocking plight of the German Jews was flagged in, and I read an interesting intelligence report about this, and interestingly enough, it mentioned how, according to officers on the ground, after Kristallnacht in November 1938, it commented on the, not only the degree of devastation inside Germany against the Jewish population, but it also pointed out how a lot of Germans were actually horrified also by what their own government were doing. Insofar as that mattered, I'm not so sure it did. Whether or not we had the resources to actually focus on that, again, when you've got a very limited budget and you very limited number of officers whose workload is obviously extremely busy, how do you prioritize all these different things? How do you keep an eye on the fate of the German Jews, which is obviously horrendous, but at the same time run agents to keep track on things like German rearmament? There is a certain priority, and of course you've got maybe a handful of case officers working in various places in Germany. How do you allocate these budgets to work out where you spend the money and the time and the resources to get the information you want? So, of course, when you look through these reports, it's things like German rearmament that would be the priority. And I'm not saying that as though it's a criticism of the British intelligence or French intelligence or whatever. It's just with hindsight, obviously, we know what happened from 1942 with the Holocaust happening. But I think it would be harsh to say that that sort of thing is necessarily foreseeable before 1939. I think it's very questionable that it was.
You talked about being able to view some of the intelligence documents coming out of Poland and the Czech and Czechoslovakia, as it was then. That must have been A, fascinating, but B, also quite haunting, I would imagine.
Well, yes, you can. I mean, a lot of these documents obviously are unattainable, but fragments of them are accessible in various archives and sometimes in places you don't expect to find. So though, for example, the British intelligence archives are all closed, they are referred to and quoted in some Foreign Office documents and indeed in a lot of French intelligence documents. The French documents are much more available than their British counterparts because they were seized in 1940 by the Germans and then taken to Berlin. And then, of course, in 1945, the Russians then took them back to Moscow. And then in the 1990s, they were repatriated to Paris. And again, this is true of lots of the archives in or elsewhere in Europe, some of which are still emerging and being discovered. And they're turning up in all sorts of different places. But yeah, it is very exciting. I mean, you see some of these documents. I came across, and it said that this document must be destroyed after being read. And unfortunately, it wasn't, to state the obvious, but it does reveal things like details about, without mentioning the name, details about certain informants at a very high level within Hitler's circle. And of course, it's very difficult not to be slightly excited by those sort of documents when you come across them.
What do you hope that people will take from the book, Spying on the Reich?
Well, I think it's a lesson for the future. I think it's it can open one's eyes about how, for example, threats can be assessed in the present day and the kind of challenges that confront every intelligence services in every situation and how difficult it actually is to make priority judgments about what needs to be looked at with the right degree of care that every threat poses. I mean, a very simple example from the relative present day is 7/7 and the bombers who blew up the London Underground in 2005. They slipped through the net, obviously, when MI5 were unable to get them in time, but to be fair to intelligence services, I say to actually be confronted by these threats in circumstances of this time is very, very daunting and difficult. And I think that my book would hopefully be a reminder of those sort of difficulties.
The book is called Spying on the Reich, The Cold War Against Hitler. It's by R.T. Roger Howard. Roger, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure, pleasure. Nice to talk to you. Take care.